150 years ago tonight, America lay breathless and devastated. The actions of the past week had wreaked havoc in Virginia at a wilderness crossroads called Chancellorsville. And thousands of young men and promising young lives have been killed, crushed, crippled, and maimed, all in a white heat moment of passion known as combat. There would be bloodier battles to come in this civil war, but not many. And a century and a half ago tonight, no one on this continent had experienced so profound a bloodletting as this last week, this Chancellorsville. Soldiers were dead and dying tonight, some barely clinging to life. Families all across America were just learning that they were now transformed into widows and orphans, or had lost brothers and sons in the woods of Virginia. More and more would be made with every passing hour, and more would be notified with each hour. And some would never even have the solace of that certainty as their loved ones lay in unmarked graves or hidden deep in the leafy fastness of the wilderness. The effects of Chancellorsville would reverberate and ripple across this continent, from Atlantic to Pacific, from Maine to Mississippi, from California to the Carolinas. 1863 would be a year of bold decisions and intense actions and in marquee battles and unspeakable losses. The Union was imperiled, the government in crisis, and a people seeking an answer and longing for a leader to shepherd them out of the darkness. The Confederacy was dwindling, dying, its resources limited and disappearing. Its resolve willed it forward, but the flower of its manhood was already consumed, and more would follow. And none typified this pathos better than what happened here to one soldier in this American Iliad 150 years ago. Lieutenant General Thomas Jonathan Jackson, Stonewall Jackson, had reached the very pinnacle of his career in 1863 when he routed an entire Union Army Corps and set the stage for Lee's greatest victory. But in that moment of triumph, Stonewall Jackson was caught in the mistaken fire of his own men and was shot three times on the evening of May 2nd, 1863. One bullet penetrated the palm of his right hand, and two bullets penetrated his left arm, one high, one low, and that necessitated amputation. Jackson was hurried to a field hospital near the Wilderness Tavern, where Dr. Hunter Holmes McGuire, medical director of the Confederate Second Corps, was compelled to operate at about 2 a.m. on May 3rd. He removed Jackson's left arm just 1 inch above the highest wound, just 2 inches below the shoulder. And shortly after that, Jackson was placed in an ambulance and evacuated southward to here. Jackson was taken away from Chancellorsville to get him away from the immediate danger of the battle still going on there. And yet Jackson's doctor, Hunter McGuire, had an ulterior motive for bringing him here. He desired to link up with the railroad at Guinea Station and evacuate Jackson to the hospitals in Richmond. They already had a house set up for Jackson. They already had doctors anticipating the patient. All they needed was Stonewall Jackson. In 1863, Guinea Station, this beautiful, quiet, bucolic site, was one of the busiest places in all the Upper Confederacy. This was the supply base for Robert E. Lee's entire army. So everything that fed, armed, and equipped the army was brought by rail to this point and disseminated to the front by wagon. Correspondingly, everything leaving the army, the wounded, the sick, the prisoners, the dead, also were brought here through this choke point, this conduit, and sent southward. And Stonewall Jackson was no exception. If Jackson needed a train, he had to come here. But the whole purpose of bringing Stonewall Jackson to Guinea Station was moot, because before they could even arrive, the rail service had stopped. Union cavalry, which had been notoriously absent on the battlefield at Chancellorsville, suddenly reemerged far to the rear of the battle lines at Chancellorsville, and cavalry under Major General George Stoneman was raiding along Lee's line of communication, his line of supplies, his railroads, this railroad. He cut this railroad on May 4th at Ashland, literally while Jackson was en route to this destination. Nothing was getting in or out of Guinea Station, and as a result, the wounded and the prisoners began to flood the areas surrounding us. They filled the fields and the woods, and hospital tents were quickly erected for their comfort. Officers were placed in most of the houses of the neighborhood, and Jackson was going to be late on the scene. They sent a rider ahead just to secure sanctuary for him. Surveying the area, Jackson's rider, his emissary, thought this was the ideal location. This was the Fairfield plantation of Thomas Coleman Chandler and his wife Mary, and it literally straddled the railroad at Guinea Station. When they approached the Chandlers about hosting Stonewall Jackson, Mrs. Chandler was delighted at the prospect. Jackson had camped on the grounds prior to the Battle of Fredericksburg, and Mrs. Chandler was rather taken with him and was anxious to have him back. She promised to make all the arrangements necessary. Jackson's emissary was so delighted at the news, he immediately returned back up the road to tell Hunter McGuire. And that was a mistake, because Mrs. Chandler suffered from what many people suffered in 1863. They knew who Stonewall Jackson was. He was literally the most famous person in the English-speaking world, perhaps. But they have a hard time understanding or reconciling themselves to what Stonewall Jackson was. Jackson was no longer an individual. Jackson came with doctors. He came with staff officers and orderlies and attendants. And together, they were Stonewall Jackson. Mrs. Chandler set aside one bed in her house, where you can see the foundation off to your left front. And then she packed the house with other wounded, worthy officers. Jackson had left the Wilderness Tavern before dawn on May 4th. And didn't arrive here until 8 o'clock that night. 15 hours on the road, everyone was exhausted. And what they assumed would be a sure thing here was found to be completely unacceptable. The house was in bedlam. And Dr. McGuire left his patient out in the yard while he went through the house and examined all of the patients personally. In all likelihood, he intended to pull rank and throw everyone out of that house. But he very carefully diagnosed an infection in the house. One of the patients was suffering from erysipelas, a strep disease, highly infectious and often lethal. In all likelihood, the patient was a brigadier general from Louisiana named Francis T. Nichols. We know that Nichols was ensconced in the house and had a warm, comfortable bed. But sometime during the night, the Chandlers, worried about their children, had him removed unceremoniously and dumped on the platform of Guinea Station, and that rarely happens to generals. If he had erysipelas, General Nichols recovered and went on to become the governor of Louisiana in the post-war years, no thanks to Hunter McGuire. But for McGuire, his principal patient, his biggest concern, was Stonewall Jackson, and he couldn't dare put Jackson in the house with an infection. And so with nowhere else to turn, he quickly improvised and asked about the little outbuilding or clapboard structure before you. When he was told that it was merely the office and far from hospitable, that was its selling point. It was virtually empty, and its only redeeming quality was that the Chandlers had just finished spring cleaning and had swept the floors and whitewashed the walls inside and out. Immediately, Hunter McGuire took the building and had the office furniture removed, the desks, the files, the ledgers, the workbenches and tools, and quickly replaced it with any kind of house furniture he could lay hands on, and they transformed it into a rustic little cottage. At 8 p.m. on the evening of May 4th, when Stonewall Jackson was taken into this building, this became his final home. Once he passed through that threshold, he would never come out of there alive. For the first couple days that Jackson was here, he did remarkably well. His strength came back to him very quickly, and Dr. McGuire literally stayed in the room with him and monitored him around the clock, putting off sleep for days on end, satisfying himself that his patient was on the road to recovery. And Jackson responded very positively. His wounds were healing ideally, according to the doctor. And as for Jackson's demeanor, he was the picture of health. He was relaxed. He was comfortable. He was talkative. Now, most of us are familiar with Stonewall Jackson being notoriously tight-lipped and secretive. But that was the professional Jackson. That was General Jackson. This patient was Thomas Jackson, a man removed from responsibility and able to indulge himself. And he did. He talked quite a bit. He talked about everything. He talked about the nickname Stonewall and how it wasn't his. It was his brigade that had earned that name at Manassas. It was their name. He talked about his opponent at Chancellorsville and how General Hooker had a fantastic plan, but he didn't follow through, and that was his undoing. He talked about his flank attack and desired to see that all his subordinates be promoted, dated May 2nd in honor of the accomplishment, thinking that it was important that subordinates should be promoted on the field in recognition of their bravery and as an incentive to the others to also emulate them. He talked about the wounding. He talked about the surgery that removed his arm. He had never experienced chloroform in his life, and it gave him a beautiful floating sensation. He also recollected hearing the most beautiful music of his entire life. Later on, he concluded he had been listening to the saw that had removed his arm. After two solid days of this type of behavior, Jackson was well on the road to recovery. He showed stamina. He showed endurance. This was not a dying man. This was a man who was getting better every hour, every day. And after two solid days of improvement, Jackson started badgering his doctor about how soon he might return to active duty. And more good news arrived, hard on the heels of that. The damage to the railroad was negligible. It was easily repaired, and the service would be restored on May 7th. Jackson, who had now rested for several days, could make that trip very easily. So a train would take him from Guinea Station on the morning of May 7th. McGuire was so content with his patient that he did something unusual on the evening of the 6th. He examined his patient one last time, and then he went to bed. It's the first night's sleep that he had indulged himself in since Jackson had been wounded 4 days before. He was exhausted. Now, history seemingly has a rather ironic sense of timing, because it's that night that everything changes. It's that night, as the doctor drowses on a chaise lounge in this little clapboard building. And that night, the trains start to whistle and blow as they bring up steam in Richmond, that Jackson woke up violently ill. At 1 a.m., Jackson became intensely nauseated. He had trouble breathing. He suffered from severe pains at his side and a very high fever. Eventually, Dr. McGuire was awakened, and he diagnosed his patient as suffering from pleuropneumonia of the right side. There really was no good cure for pneumonia in 1863. Almost one-third of all the fatalities by disease were by pneumonia. There was a chance of almost 23 or 25% mortality rate once one has pneumonia. But the disease that Jackson was showing was peculiar. The symptoms were familiar, but they were not the initial phase of the disease. They were a very far advanced stage of pneumonia. So the real difficulty with Stonewall Jackson was that he was sick all along. History often portrays Jackson as a wounded man who got sick and eventually died. But in truth, it might be the other way around. Jackson was a sick man who got wounded and wound up here. Out on the battlefield, Jackson was shivering violently and bundled in every piece of clothing he owned on May 2nd, when men were literally dropping from heat stroke. He was wearing a raincoat the night he was shot under an almost full moon, albeit a clear sky. One who had seen him on the field noted that the general was so ill he was unfit for command and could barely sit his horse. But after he was wounded, all those symptoms had disappeared, and that's because of the shock or the trauma, not only of being shot, but also experiencing surgery, losing almost 7 units of blood, almost half his blood count, to the point where his doctor confessed that he was almost entirely pulseless because his blood pressure had dropped that far. And then being carted 27 miles over back roads to here. No wonder Jackson was traumatized. But as his strength returned, the trauma would subside, and the true nature of Jackson's health would also reveal itself. Without really a very good acceptable cure for pneumonia in 1863, Hunter McGuire didn't accept that. He started bringing in doctors left and right to work with him. He sent for several army doctors, including a kinsman of Mrs. Jackson, a doctor named Samuel D. Morrison, chief surgeon of Jubal Early's division. He also sent for Robert T. Breckinridge and J. Philip Smith. And when he was certain of Jackson's illness, he sent off to Richmond for a civilian specialist in pneumonia. One of the heads of the Medical College of Richmond, of Medical College of Virginia, David H. Tucker. Eventually, there would be five doctors working with Jackson here. And in one moment, Jackson even commented, saying, "I see from the number of physicians that you think my condition dangerous." And indeed it was. Amidst all these people congregating at the Fairfield Plantation, coming to Guinea Station, there was one more very important person who arrived here, and that was Mrs. Jackson. Marianna Jackson had been in Richmond when informed that her husband had been wounded. Her impulse was to join him at once, but for the reason Jackson couldn't get to Richmond, Mrs. Jackson couldn't get to Guinea Station. They had to wait until the rail line was restored. On the morning of May 7th, she was on the first train to Guinea Station. She arrived here sometime around noon, just about 11 hours after her husband had collapsed. She was met at the station by one of Jackson's most beloved staff officers, a lovable, affable man named James Power Smith. Everyone referred to him as Jimmy. Mrs. Jackson knew Jimmy Smith very well. They had a comfortable relationship as friends to the point where Smith felt free to give her a pet name and called her the Lieutenant Generaless when her husband was promoted to Lieutenant General. Mrs. Jackson was delighted to see him, but instantly worried when he became evasive to her questions about her husband's health. As she showed up on the ground, she wasn't allowed admittance to see her husband right away, as Dr. McGuire was working with him at that moment. She was left on the front porch of the main house to fret. Out in the yard, she saw a Confederate detail exhuming the remains of a dead Confederate officer. She quickly learned that it was a brigadier general named Elijah Franklin Paxton, Bull Paxton. And that was a blow, because Bull Paxton was a Jackson neighbor and friend. He, too, was from Lexington, Virginia. One general had been removed from these grounds with a serious illness. Another was being removed in a coffin. And a third general's fate had yet to be determined in this building. Mrs. Jackson said it was like the entire breath was knocked out of her when she thought of Paxton and how his wife had become an instant widow. And then she worried about her own fate. She became so utterly distracted that the people of the plantation decided to put her to work. They had her make lemonade, and a glass was sent into the office. And the first connection between husband and wife was a glass of lemonade. Regrettably, nobody had watched Mrs. Jackson. And as Jackson took a deep draft from the glass, he immediately spit it back into the glass and thrust it back at Jimmy Smith, saying, "You didn't stir this correctly. It's too sweet. It's wrong." And the first connection between husband and wife had somehow fallen short. When Mrs. Jackson was admitted to the office, she admitted she had seen it, her husband died 8 days before at the very pinnacle and prime of his manhood. And now he was debilitated and weakened to the point where he barely recognized her. She had to sit with him for quite some time before he was even aware of her presence. Walking into a crisis like that, Mrs. Jackson opted to stay in the room with her husband and help minister to him. Over the next 3 days, she would be a pillar of strength in that building. Only for brief moments would Mrs. Jackson leave that office so that she could take care of their 6-month-old infant daughter, Julia. The next 3 days would be days of uncertainty here. Jackson's decline was not a steady downfall. In retrospect, Guinea Station is once again Guinea Station. In 1863, Guinea Station was anything but quiet, so this is welcomed sound. As I was saying, Jackson's last 3 days were tremendously unpredictable. Instead of a steady downfall and decline, Jackson was a tremendously erratic patient. There were times when he was very close to a coma. There were times when he was quite alert and lucid. And then moments beyond that, he would slip into delirium and start shouting commands as if he was back out on the battlefield. And this would repeat the cycle again and again. This very day, 150 years ago, Jimmy Smith sat down at noontime to write a letter to his sister, to let her know what was transpiring in this building. He started off in the darkest of tones, confessing that the general, he's been sinking during the morning. But the curious thing about Smith's note was that before he could even finish the sentence, he changed his mind. But he's doing better now, the doctors think. Jackson could change that abruptly that he could make Jimmy Smith change his mind in mid-sentence. Nobody really knew what was happening here. By this evening, May 9th, Stonewall Jackson was no longer in intense pain, but he was showing signs of exhaustion, and his breathing, while not labored, was very shallow and disturbing. There were two people here who suspected that the end was not far off. One of them was Jackson's chaplain, Beverly Tucker Lacey. Lacey had been here every day to have morning prayers with Jackson and then would return back to camp to be available to the troops. He had carried messages from Robert A. Lee to Stonewall Jackson. Lee's message telling Jackson that Jackson has lost his left arm, but I have lost my right arm. Carrying messages such as, give him my affectionate regards and tell him to make haste and come back to me, not the army, but to me. On this evening of the 9th, Reverend Lacey didn't want to leave this place because he didn't think he would ever see his friend again. Jackson, on the other hand, ordered Lacey to go back to camp and not return tomorrow. For May 10th was a Sunday, and he desired the chaplain to hold services in the camps. Reluctantly, Reverend Lacey obeyed the order. He reported to Robert E. Lee and confessed that he thought the end was at hand. And Lee, uncharacteristically, became very emotional and told the minister, you are wrong, sir. You're wrong. Surely God will not take him from us now that we need him so much. And dismissed him. This is a bigger one. It's two cars. Two engines. So rarely do they get to an audience to perform to. So we can understand if they're a bit overstimulated tonight. On May 10th, Robert E. Lee sought out Reverend Lacey and overrode Jackson's order and sent him back here, carrying one last message, an interesting message, a revealing one about both these men. Clinging to hope, Robert E. Lee told Reverend Lacey that he was sure that he was going to find his general better this day. And then when the opportunity arises, I wish you to give him my love and tell him I have wrestled in prayer this past evening as I believe I never have on my own behalf. And those were truly stirring words. Love, the strongest emotion emitted by mankind. But it was genuine, and Lee proved it when he said that he had wrestled in prayer as he never had. Let's keep this in mind, that Robert E. Lee's daughter had died not 6 months prior to this. But in the immediacy of this crisis, Lee felt almost more overwrought at the impending loss of the man in this building. Reverend Lacey came back, but Jackson never heard those words. He was too late. Another person this evening who suspected that the end was at hand was Marianna Jackson. She had sat with her husband and kept vigil by his bedside. She had read to him incessantly, whether he is awake and coherent or not. She often read to him from the Bible, which was their wont to do. He was a deacon in the Presbyterian faith, and she was the daughter of a Presbyterian minister. Religion, faith, was a salient feature of their relationship. And this night, she volunteered to read to him from the Psalms. And Jackson startled her by saying that he was too tired. Mrs. Jackson was taken aback and literally felt herself compelled to ask again. And this time, her husband rallied for her and said, "We should never turn away from the Psalms." But no sooner had she begun reading this evening when Jackson, or Mrs. Jackson, I should say, changed her mind. She didn't want to read to him from the Psalms. Perhaps emotion was creeping into her voice and betraying her. But she suddenly volunteered that maybe the staff officers should come and join her, and together they should sing some of the general's favorite hymns. He agreed, and they were brought in. And as they gathered by his bedside, they sang several hymns, including one called "Show Pity, Lord," which was based off the 51st Psalm. And it went by the tune of Old Hundredth. It had a rather interesting, if not ironic, line to it. "Show pity, Lord. O Lord, forgive. Let a repenting rebel live. Are not thy mercies large and free? May not a sinner trust in thee?" Tonight would be a long night, a tortured night, a night of anticipation. As the sun sets in 4 minutes, this would be the last sunset of Stonewall Jackson's life 150 years ago. May 10th, 1863, dawned as a beautiful spring day around Guinea Station. And the doctors came in early, they examined their patient, and then retired to a side room where they consulted and agreed that Jackson was beyond their help. At that point, they quietly ushered Mrs. Jackson out of her husband's room, and on the front porch of this building, Dr. Samuel Morrison broke the bad news to her that the end was at hand. Mrs. Jackson broke down, and they refused to let her back in the building lest she upset the general. So she stifled her tears just to get admittance. She thought it was absolutely imperative that her husband know what was happening. And when the doctor seemed reluctant to share that, she took it upon herself to break the news. And in the end, it was a wise choice, because Mrs. Jackson handled it in a beautiful fashion. She knelt beside her husband's bed and broke the news by posing it as a question. "If God wills you to go today, do you not feel willing to acquiesce in his allotment?" She had to repeat the question several times before Jackson was roused from a stupor, and then he eventually answered, "I'd prefer it." And those are consoling words, but Mrs. Jackson was not certain. She waited until he was a little bit more awake, a little bit more coherent, a little bit more alert. And she asked her question again, and this time she got an entirely different answer. And Jackson said, "Death is not so near." And that went contrary to everything she implied. At that moment, Marianna Jackson broke down. She burst into tears and fell across her husband. And it was Jackson who took to comforting her. But to Mrs. Jackson's infinite credit, she very quickly recomposed herself and in a very matter-of-fact way explained exactly what the doctors had told her. And she made her point. Jackson demanded to see Dr. McGuire at once. And as the doctor came into his room, Jackson pointed out, "Anna tells me I'm to die this day. Is that so?" It was the question all of the doctors here had been hoping to avoid. But confronted with it, Dr. McGuire became forthright. And the thing that astounded him was Jackson's reaction. Instead of being upset, Jackson relaxed. Stonewall Jackson smiled at everyone in the room. And all he said was simply, "Good. That's good. It's all right." In that instant, Jackson not only understood what was happening to him, but accepted. And perhaps we should make the case embraced what was happening to him. Within the hour, he was left alone with his de facto chief of staff, his assistant adjutant general, Alexander Swift Pendleton, better known to everyone as Sandy Pendleton. Pendleton was a man who could handle corps on the march and carry orders in battle. But he was also only 24 years old, and his hero was dying, and he found that unnerving. He had arrived here on May 10th to find Jackson asleep, and even then, he was uncomfortable. He wound up migrating in Jackson's room physically, as far away from Jackson's bed as he could be. And when Jackson woke up, they were alone. The young man was paralyzed, and Jackson had to strike a conversation with him, asking him how things were in the camps that day. And immediately Pendleton came gushing back, "Oh, sir, we've all been praying for you." And Jackson smiled and thanked him, but most importantly, he had him talking because he wanted to share something with Pendleton. He told Jackson that it is the Lord's Day. "My wish is fulfilled. I have always desired to die on Sunday, the most beautiful and holy day of the week." This is an amazing statement. So many dying people are easily disoriented. They lose a sense of time or place. But Jackson knows exactly what day it was on May 10th, 1863. He knew it was Sunday. And the statement was precise and clinical, just like Stonewall Jackson. He wasn't afraid of this day. He wasn't afraid of what was happening to him. He considered this day his day, a vindication of his faith, and he reveled in it. As a result, he tried to keep his mind sharp as close to the end as possible to continue to witness this amazing experience to those around him. He shares it with Sandy Pendleton instead of sharing it with his wife or his doctors or the other staff officers. And that, too, is clinical because Sandy Pendleton was more than a chief of staff. He was a divinity student, and Jackson was witnessing his faith to a man he thought would be filling the pulpits. He had no way of knowing that Sandy Pendleton would be a fatality of this war and would be consumed in 1864. Nor would he know that in that death, this very story would resonate for 150 years, well beyond whatever could have happened in the pulpit with one simple sermon. Jackson's daughter was summoned, and they laid her on the pillow beside his head. And he cooed to her and saying, "My darling, my little one, my little comforter." And that was the only moment that Mrs. Jackson would truly value out of this entire experience at Guinea Station. But Jackson was engaged a battle that even he could not win. A battle for his very life. And about an hour, maybe an hour and a half before the end, Stonewall Jackson slipped entirely into delirium and did not return. He started to ramble quite a bit, talking very freely, sometimes barely audible as a whisper, other times just booming at the top of his lungs, calling on various officers like General A.P. Hill to press forward Hill, cut them off, pass the infantry to the fore. He's calling on various staff officers and orderlies. According to the people in that room, Jackson was literally reliving the last 2 years of his life, and he could pick out distinct moments from his past based on what he was saying. Anything from a simple dinner conversation with the mess to evening prayers with staff officers to quiet moments with Mrs. Jackson. But always, Jackson came back to Chancellorsville. And always, he'd start shouting his orders, calling on people, some of them right beside his bed, like Sandy Pendleton, to have Pendleton see to it, have Pendleton take care of that. He'll become upset and shout out, "Where is Pendleton? Pendleton, I want you to see if there's any high ground up behind Chancellor's." As he worked his way through a litany of staff officers, he became very worked up, very taut, He literally thrust himself up out of the bed in an upward fetal position, and the pain was excruciating. And Dr. Hunter McGuire admitted something at this point that very few would ever say. He said, "I left the room then, unable in my enfeebled condition to restrain my grief at seeing him die." And he left him in the hands of Dr. Tucker because it was too overwhelming. As Jackson became more and more worked up, he called for his commissary officer, Wells Hawks, and shouted, "Tell Major Hawks to..." But he stopped in mid-sentence. And at that point, Jackson just completely relaxed. He sank into his bed, was quiet for a moment, and then startled everyone by smiling. It was a smile of ineffable sweetness. And Jackson whispered in a light voice, "Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees." Mrs. Jackson, too, was becoming overwhelmed, and she turned to Dr. Tucker and said, "Doctor, can't you do something more?" And Dr. Tucker just shook his head and said, "No, madam. Human power can do no more." Jackson heard his wife and her plaintive cry, and he opened his eyes and looked at her. And then a moment beyond that, he closed his eyes forever. Stonewall Jackson died in this little building on the afternoon of May 10th, 1863, at 3:15. He had survived his wounds only by 8 days. The death of Stonewall Jackson sent shockwaves throughout the Confederacy. When Lee heard the news, he confessed to his own wife, "I don't know how to replace him." Confederate President Jefferson Davis called the general's demise a great national calamity. Peter Alexander of the Southern Literary Messenger eulogized Jackson, saying, "He is the idol of the people and is the object of greater enthusiasm than any other military chieftain in our day." And soldiers and civilians agreed to that. A member of the 21st Georgia wrote, "A greater hero never lived. If we could only see Jackson, we were all right." An Englishman noted that the sight of him, and of him alone, stirred the blood like a trumpet, and the words, "Stonewall is coming," carried confidence to his friends and terror to his foes. And sometimes, just the thought of Stonewall Jackson, sight unseen, inspired men. A young Missouri captain named Norval Spangler fell mortally wounded at the Battle of Champions Hill, Mississippi, on May 16th, 1863, shortly after news of Stonewall Jackson's death was reported. Spangler announced on his deathbed to his friends, "I guess I'll take my supper with Stonewall Jackson tonight." So many worthy Confederate officers had fallen in the West, but Spangler and his nation were fixated on the Virginian who died here at Guinea Station. Southerners obviously mourned their general, but so did the surprising number of Northerners and much of the English-speaking world. Union soldiers sought out veteran officers of the old army to hear tales of Stonewall Jackson in better days before this war. The Philadelphia Press lamented the death of the great captain, even though he fought for the Confederacy. President Abraham Lincoln wrote to that editor, John W. Forney, to thank him for his appropriate words and to express his own admiration for Jackson, calling him a gallant man. British newspapers lionized the fallen Stonewall with an unexpected degree of empathy. The Times of London reflected, "Even on this side of the ocean, the gallant soldier's fate will everywhere be heard of with pity and sympathy. Not only as a brave man, but as one of the consummate generals that this century has produced." In that sentence alone, they instantly catapulted Jackson to the front row of great captains of the century, where he stood side by side with the likes of Napoleon and their own Duke of Wellington. The Times concluded, Stonewall Jackson will carry with him to his early grave the regrets of all who can admire greatness and genius. An English admirer wrote at the time, it is impossible to look at the house where he lay without a mist coming over the eyes and a choking sense of suffocation rising in the throat. Jackson's untimely death was deeply affecting for many who knew him and countless more who only knew of him. Regardless of one's politics or ideals, both North and South and throughout much of the English-speaking world, they recognized the genius of this enigmatic man, this amazingly gifted general, this powerful symbol. Jackson was the self-made man, made good, and yet there was a certain symmetry in his life. He was born of humble origins in the hinterlands of Western Virginia. He was orphaned and with little prospect in this world. And yet Jackson willed himself to get an education, to strive to reach the upper middle class, to excel as a phenomenal captain, and to become a living legend. And all end up dying here, in a borrowed bed, in a stranger's office. And there was a certain symmetry in his death as well, and the thousands of deaths that preceded him, and the thousands that would follow him. His life and his passing became the symbolic passing of a generation of heroes and good men, determined to do their duty, regardless of the cost, perhaps, in spite of the cost, certainly. And as the candles flicker and go out tonight, so too did many lives of brave men 150 years ago tonight, Stonewall Jackson among them. Tonight marks the 150th anniversary of Lieutenant General Thomas Jonathan Jackson's last night on earth among the living. Tomorrow would see the end of his suffering and sacrifice. The war would go on without him. The world would go on without him. But the world would forever carry Stonewall Jackson in its memory and in its heart. In 1863 and tonight. Thank you.